I'm familiar with much of your work, too. I've read a number of your books over the years. I especially remember the book that you did on Lindbergh.
Oh, did you? Yes. Well, that's interesting, because they're both practical jokers.
Yeah. I had a long-time fascination with Walt Disney, and one of the reasons that I liked your biography, Disney's World, is I didn't read the Bob Green biography a few years ago, but I have a feeling knowing...
Bob Thomas.
Bob Thomas, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's a very good. It's a very good one. You know, I mean, he's a first-class newspaper man, and I think he misses, to a certain extent, the heart of Walt, the reason why he was a great American.
Well, I have.
And I think that's inevitable with Bob Thomas. He is so methodical and so good and so beautiful in his research that he sometimes skims over the raison d'etre of why a man is great. And I have a feeling that Bob was a little cynical about great man, and I think that's great fault of all of us newspaper men, that sometimes we are apt to not see the greatness in great people.
Well, you certainly saw the greatness in Disney, but you also put Disney in perspective. There were several things that you wrote about which surprised me. And maybe you could comment on these. One was Disney's temper. And his even though his staff, as you point out throughout the book, loved him, he tended to mistreat his staff. You also show that he was anti-Semitic, and he made perpetual references to, scathing references to Jews and Jewish bankers. Very conservative and very much afraid of the communist conspiracy. And, of course, he also abused his health by chain-smoking. So, in addition to the genius that you obviously portray here in Disney's World, you also show Walt Disney as being a man. So why can't you tell me a little bit about Disney, the man?
Well, I think that he reached a turning point in his life. And he reached a turning point in his life when he started life as a great father figure. He always thought, he resented his own father because his father was a puritanical, very good man, but he was a puritanical bully. And he had all the right ideas, but he had them in such a heavy fashion that he turned all his sons away from him. And one by one, his sons left home and ran away to found their fortunes in other spheres. And Walt Disney always determined that he would never do that. He would be a good father. But what he didn't realize was that when he had these brilliant ideas for creating cartoon characters like Mickey Mouse and Oswald the Rabbit, which is one of the great ones which was stolen away from him in the early days, when he had these great ideas, he wanted to hold on to them, and he employed people who were better sketch artists than he was. He could catalyze, he could do the original drawings, but it needed other people of genius to put them onto the screen and animate them. And Albert Iwerks was one of the great people who worked with him and was one of the greatest animators of all time. And he didn't pay them very well because he never spent any money on himself. He made a lot of money for him, from his films. But all the money was turned back into making his films, his cartoons, better. And therefore he didn't think that people needed money. If they had money troubles, come to me. I'll bail you out. If your wife is sick, I'll send her to the hospital. Send the bills to me. This was his attitude. And then suddenly, changing times, and the unions came up. They'd already come up in most of the other Hollywood studios. And for almost 7 or 8 years, they didn't affect Disney. It was a non-union shop. Everybody worked for him because they admired him. They worked for him, and which is very unusual in Hollywood, they worked for him without credit. Can you imagine anybody? I mean, the great scramble in Hollywood is always for credit. Who did so-and-so? I want my name on the screen, and they insist on that. And they didn't get it with Disney. It was always a Walt Disney film. And no matter if he did the original drawings, or if he paced up and down on the stage and showed what Goofy looked like by raising his eyebrows or snickering his nostrils, that was his invention. He allowed nobody else to get the credit. Norm Ferguson invented Goofy, but he never got the credit for it. And he felt he should do. And, but...
It would have been an easy thing to do, to have a list of credits or animators on the screen at some point, wouldn't it?
It would have been very difficult, but, you know, this is the way in which people work. If you work in Hollywood, you want credit.
But I mean, for Disney, simply as the... And the way the credits are given in any movie, just simply give a list of credits for the animators.
He did it for his first major feature film.
Snow White.
The first time for Snow White. And then that was when the movies moved in, the unions moved in and said, we want credits for everybody. And everybody, and they did, it was a very interesting thing, you see, when Snow White was made and the credits came in, people began to ring up and say, that's wonderful work you did inventing the prince, or Snow White, or the seven dwarfs. And they realized what credits really meant, and the unions got a handle on them, and they moved in and they tried to, and 40% of the studio went on strike. And that was the turning point in Walt Disney's life. It was settled. But it was settled in favor of the unions. And Walt never forgave the 40% of people who went on strike. And there was one particular man who was a man he was fondest of. He was one of his great animators, Art Babbitt. And he invented all sorts of characters. But he said, I'll never forgive him, because he felt that he led the strike and he shouted insults at him and he wanted to pump him on the nose. Once when he was picketing outside the studio, and he said, that man will never come back to work for my studio. When they settled with the unions, in favor of the unions, and Disney became unionized, Art Babbitt had to sue to get his job back. The union had to take a suit, and he got his job back, but he was ostracized, what we call in England, sent to Coventry. Nobody would talk to him. All the loyal Disney people ignored him, and he found it terrible. And when he went into the army in World War II, the word had got out that he was a communist and a left wing and a militant. And every time he came up for officer school, he was cut down. He never got an officer's job. And he came out of the army, he got his job back, never any good, and finally he said, the hell with this, and left. And was never fulfilled again. That's the tragic thing, that Art Babbitt, one of the greatest animators of all time, never got a job again.
Well, in spite
because,
of,
well, no, but let me make the point that Disney was so good, even though so tyrannical, that it was not worth working for anybody else because you couldn't make it.
Well, in spite of Disney's flaws, he does seem to come off a lot better than many of the Hollywood producers who have such an unsavory reputation. I mean, the Disney studio still seems like, not talking about the one today, but the time when Walt was alive, it still seemed like a rather stable, substantial
organization. Can you imagine Jack Warner or Louis B. Mayer making films? They never made a film in their life. All they did was dandle starlets on their knees or put stars on the casting office couch. That's all they did. They never did anything creative. Walt was a creator. He imagined these characters. He got Mickey Mouse, for example. He thought of him from the little mouse when he was starving in an office above a Greek restaurant. In Kansas City, there was a mouse that came out of a hole, climbed up the desk, came across, and sat in his hand and ate. And they shared a meal together. That's all the meal they had. A can of bully beef, the odd bit of cheese, and some bread. And that's all they had to keep themselves going. And he shared it with a mouse. He never forgot that mouse. When he had left, and when he had no more money left, no more food left, and when the Greek boys down below stopped feeding him, he said, they'll kill my mouse, they'll put the cat on it, they'll put a trap on it. So he drove out, and he spent his last money going out into the countryside and releasing the mouse into the woods. Maybe stupid, but he couldn't bear the idea that they would kill his mouse. And this mouse stayed in his mind. And when he had Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, who was a great character whom he'd invented, stolen away from him, and he had to invent a new character, and his brother Roy said, God, we've got the money, we've got no money. What are you going to do, invent a dog? You'd go and pee against all the trees in the neighborhood. We get an easy laugh for about 3 weeks, and then we're done. What are you going to invent? He said, I've got a mouse. What are you going to call him? Mortimer Mouse. That's no good. Who wants to go and see Mortimer Mouse? And then Lily, his wife, she claims, said, what about calling him Mickey? And Mickey Mouse was born. And Mickey Mouse was originally drawn by Walt in his own image. He looked in the mirror and he saw himself with his pointed nose and his little trim moustache, whiskers out here, and his fallible chin. And he invented not only Mickey Mouse, but the character of Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse was always rushing in to help old ladies and getting bopped on the head for doing it, for going against people twice his size, which is Walt. And he gave it Walt's voice, too. He falsettoed his own voice and put it into it. And he became one of the greatest characters of all time. The only time that Mickey Mouse started to fail at the box office, because everybody said, that is Walt. And then his mother said, I think you're making yourself rather effeminate by putting your voice up like that. And when he realized his mother, whom he adored, he didn't like his father particularly, his mother whom he adored, didn't like his voice, he began to lose enthusiasm for Mickey Mouse and his own image of Mickey Mouse, and it started to fail at the box office.
Well, Mickey may have been in Walt Disney's image, but Walt had better ears. You've written an awful lot of nonfiction and fiction, too. When you started the task of doing the biography of Walt Disney, you have several pages of acknowledgments here, but this was a rather major task. How much cooperation did you get from the surviving Disney family in doing this book?
Very little. From the start, they tried to discourage me. And that goes for the Disney organization, too. They don't want an honest, independent biography. They don't want their great hero, Uncle Walt, who's rather like the idealized idea of Uncle Sam, to be sullied by the fact that he had to go to the bathroom sometimes, and he had warts on his face sometimes, and sometimes he had a sore throat. And this is what is essential to me when I write about people like Charles Lindbergh or the Dulles brothers or any other character I've ever done a biography of. The men I admire must have faults, because I cannot bear the idea that a hero is perfect. I don't believe it. I believe that you are created to have faults, you have fallibilities and weaknesses. And the more weaknesses you have, the more you overcome them, the more Superman you become. Charles Lindbergh was such a man. He made all sorts of mistakes, which I saw at close hand in Nazi Germany. And Walt Disney, all through the years when I was a film critic, I saw that men hated him. They didn't hate him because he was not a great man. They hated him because he was an egotistic man, a driving man. He would sacrifice everything to get on the screen what he wanted to get onto the screen. And you realize he was one of the most profligate men in the United States. Every penny he got, he spent. But he didn't spend it on himself. He didn't spend it on his wife. He didn't spend it on his daughters. He spent it on his films, to make his films better. And he didn't even spend it on his animators. That's the trouble. And that's what started all the trouble. His animators hated him because he never gave them a living wage.
Now, Leonard Mosley, were you able to get interviews with the surviving members of the Disney family?
Yes, I've talked to Ron Miller and to his wife Diane. His mother, his wife Lily is still alive, a very old lady, and no, I didn't talk to her.
Now, many of the documents that you cite came from the Disney archives. Were they open to you?
They were open to me. I claimed the right, as any other scholar, to go into the Disney archives, and they allowed me to see everything, and not only that, they were wonderful. And on all previous biographies, they have said, we will allow our archives to be examined. If you choose to write a critical biography or criticize Walt Disney, then that's fine, you can do it, but we will not give you any of our photographs, and we own the copyright of all the most valuable and interesting photographs. And I decided I needed the photographs, but I would not allow my text to be examined by them. And it was not.
How did you get the photographs? You have a lot of them.
And I have all the photographs, and they decided, I think that this is one of the decisive moments in history when they have decided that they have made a mistake, that they've misread the minds of the American public, and the American public does not want its heroes to be over-polished and over-burnished. They have at last decided that the American public has grown up, and it can accept the fact that a great man can have faults, that a great man lacks virtues, a great man can be nasty-tempered, not a particularly manly man, and that Walt Disney had motives quite often which were disgusting and rather nasty.
Where are the Disney archives? Are they at
the
studio?
They're in the Burbank studio. All the documents are there.
Now, this is like a library, is that correct?
Yes.
It's cataloged and everything?
They're all cataloged, and they were very helpful to me, and they showed me every document. They have all the letters from Walt Disney and Roy Disney. And one of the interesting things is that Walt Disney was one of the, from my generation, it's rather interesting. He was not gay, but he didn't like women. He thought of women in their place. He thought of women rather like Adolf Hitler and the Germans under the Nazis used to think, that the women's place was in the kitchen and the bedroom, and they produced meals and children, and that's all they were good for. He never promoted women to be directors or producers in his studio, and he also tried his best to produce a son. He produced one daughter. He tried again and again and again to produce a son. He failed. And finally, a second daughter was adopted. But he always resented the fact that his brother had a son, Roy Disney Jr., Roy Edward Disney. And as a result of that antipathy and lack of understanding between his brother's son and the son he wanted, and the lack of it, there grew up a resentment between the two, which since Walt's death has shown itself in the development of the Disney studio today.
Yes, you have a postscript here which you show the wolves really went after the studio after Walt's death.
Yes, I think I've been slightly unfair in that postscript to Roy Disney Jr., because Roy Disney Jr. is now apt and now out to justify and show that it was wrong, all the criticism of his father, of his uncle rather, of Walt Disney, and to show that his father was the great man. And he's
that
now
Roy Disney was the great man?
That Roy Disney was the great man. The money man was the great man.
But you make it clear that Roy Disney, likable
man. Oh, no,
I still maintain
that Roy Disney was the money man without the imagination. And he was the fond elder brother who always stood by, the very bright genius that Walt Disney was. But Roy Disney Jr. is out now to prove that he, the son of the dull brother, the fond brother, is better than his uncle.
Lots of luck. You'll have to do a biography of Roy one of these days.
Oh, it's a fascinating story. It really is. And he's got hold of the computer department of the animation.
What happened to Ron Miller?
And Ron Miller was chucked out by Roy Jr.
Right.
Because of his connection.
Where is Ron today?
Ron is in the wilderness.
Somewhere in the wilderness. Well, you conclude, before the postscript, you conclude with kind of an eerie note, and this reflects Walt Disney's interest in, what's it called?
Cryogenesis?
Yes, and you raise the possibility that Walt may be on ice someplace. Tell me about this.
I think he is, but I think he knew before he did it that he was going to be too late. There's this new system which is still under development, whereby somebody who dies can have their organs taken out and cleaned up and then put back. And Walt was always slightly skeptical. He studied it in great detail, but he was always slightly skeptical of how do you revive the brain. You can keep everything else freeze-dried, but how do you revive the brain? How do you get it working again? And if you work again, if you drop into an icy cold water, you can live beyond the fact when you died. There are lots of cases of people who've been brought up from icy waters and have been revived. But there's almost a problem about the brain. How do you get that revived? And Walt principally wanted to get back because he had this great dream. He wanted to create Epcot, the city of the future, which he wanted to build beside Disney World in Florida. And he believed that this would put 2, 3, 4, possibly 5 decades on the life of ordinary people by taking away the stresses and strains and the pollutions and the poisons of modern life and put them into this environment. And he thought of himself that he wanted to come back and see they didn't make a mess of this. And unfortunately, they've made a mess of it. And he's not going to come back in time because they haven't perfected the cryogenic system.
Well,
so if he's frozen down there, he's not going to get back in time, and he'd come back and find that they've made a mess of it anyway.
That's kind of far-fetched, though, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
That he is still...
But it's typical of Walt Disney that he would be interested in this. This is the driving point about this man.
Yeah.
That he was willing to take a chance and say, you know, maybe it'll work. Maybe somebody will come up with a miracle.
But even if they were to revive a dead body after many years, they would still have to, medical science would have to advance to the degree that it would be able to cure the disease that killed the person to begin with.
Let's face it.
Can't just bring him back. I mean, he had lung cancer. He had a very, and that's all.
There's never been any trouble about the cryogenetic process, about the organs of the body, the liver, the lungs, the heart. They can all be revived. It's the
but he lost, as you point out in Disney's World, he lost one lung in his operation.
Yeah.
The other lung was diseased. If he were to be brought back, assuming
he's there.
But
I think, as I very carefully pointed out in the book, that what he did is he didn't lose the lung. They took the lung out, but they took it away for regeneration. And if you know anything about thermoplasty and the removal of the lung from the human body, they can work on it.
Hmm.
I knew during World War II a very great American surgeon called Jan Fruchel, who was a general. And he could take a lung out, and he could take a diseased lung out, and he could rehabilitate that lung. He never worked out how to put it back, but he could rehabilitate the lung. And if you can rehabilitate the lung and put it in a freeze dryer, what happens then? I don't know. I may be wrong. But
well, in this case, nothing.
But this is the point about Walt Disney, was that he was willing, and this is indicative of the character of the man, that he was willing to take a chance and say, maybe I can come back.
Now, Leonard Mosley, you were born in England. Mm-hmm. Where in England were you born?
I was born near Manchester.
And yet you have a substantial number of Americans that you have done biographies on. Why is an English man? Have you become interested in these Americans, and particularly Walt Disney?
Well, let's face it, I've always had a love affair with America. I came over to America for the first time at the age of 17. I got a job on the New York Daily Mirror, which is long since deceased, and from there, through Walter Winchell, who was a very famous newspaper columnist for the Daily Mirror at that time, and from there was given a job. I was being thrown out of my apartment. I was rescued by a man called Adrian Berkowitz, whose father and mother ran Minsky's 42nd, put all the money behind Minsky's 42nd Burlesque Theatre, and I became assistant stage manager at Minsky's 42nd Burlesque Theatre. We used to have all sorts of clients, Jack Diamond, Jack Legs Diamond, Lord Castlereagh. I formed two great friendships in my life with Gypsy Rose Lee, with Anne Carrillo, and I worked as an ASM, assistant stage manager there, for $15 a week.
When was this?
This was in the early 30s, before World War II, one of the great experiences of my life. I still have friendship with Anne Carrillo. Gypsy is dead now. But I formed a good friendship with Otto Preminger, who fathered her child, and he's now since adopted her child, young Preminger, as a result of that. And they helped me when I was in trouble. They saw me all through the fraught periods of adolescence. And Anne Carrillo was one of the most beautiful girls I have ever seen. She had the most beautiful body, and I've since admired the female body particularly, because we used to call them epileptics in the audience at 42nd Street Theatre, and they would die, and nobody could sell a thing. We had a great chorus of very good-looking but rather fat and thumping Pennsylvania girls who danced around the runway, which came out into the audience. And when things got flat, Anne Carrillo she had a beautiful mink coat. In the days when mink coats, nobody had sable coats or anything, they had mink coats. She had a lovely mink coat, which one of her admirers had bought her, and she well deserved it. And when things got flat, she would get up on the stage, and she would walk across the stage and just open her coat like that. She had nothing on underneath, and the epileptics all revived, and the audience went on, and the candy butchers and everything, so like man, and we were off again.
Ah, that's a wonderful story.
A great, great experience. Then I drove across America. I bought a Model A Ford and drove across America. And this is when, which got me particularly in love with America. I had no money. I bought the car for about $124. I would stop at nights in a small town in America, knock on a door and say, could I rent a room for the night? They would ask me in. And almost invariably, we would sit on the porch at night and talk about the things I knew. They'd never seen trains, a lot of them. They'd never seen buses. I told them about double-decker London buses where they could drive around London. And they would tell me about their things, what there was around them. And I would offer to pay them. I would share their evening meal. I would have breakfast with them. I would offer to pay, and almost invariably they refused it. And not only that, but a son or a daughter or somebody had crept out during the night, looked over my car, and tuned it up, mended the thing. It was a pretty rackety car, and put a little cache of food on the seat so that when I drove away, I had food for the day.
Have you lived in the United States ever since that time?
No. I've been a foreign correspondent most of my life. I've been all over the world. But I have no roots except in this country.
Where is your home base here? Where do you live?
I have a house on an island on the Mexican Gulf in Florida. That's on Fort Myers.
Fort Myers, yes.
Captiva Island.
Oh, that's beautiful. Where they have the seashells. I've been there.
Oh,
many
yes.
Times. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where Anne Morrow Lindbergh, I wrote Lindbergh's biography on Anne Morrow Lindbergh, when she had the one thing which I didn't put in the Lindbergh biography at her request, when she had the great quarrel with her husband, and they were about to split up. She went to Captiva Island, and she wrote the book about shells called A Gift from the Sea.
Yeah.
And the house is still there.
How is Captiva in Sanibel now that there's a causeway? When I used to go many years ago, we had to take the ferry out.
Well, there's still 800 people there. The end of it is South East Plantation. But it's a lovely island. It's the world that...
Is that your permanent address?
Yes. We're going through a phase now when my wife is finding the gardening situation there. We have 2 acres of land there between the islands on the bird sanctuary. And she's finding it hard to cope. So we're thinking, we're exploring around and exploring in California at the moment, in the desert there. We like solitude. We like animals. We like birds.
With all that sand, you don't have to do any gardening. Well, what can we expect next from Leonard Mosley with a huge credit of books now, and you're certainly going to keep it up, I'm sure. So what can we look forward to from you?
Well, I'd like to do a biography of Steven Spielberg, who strikes me as being one of the most interesting young Americans coming up.
He just got married today, or I was announced today, to Amy Irving.
Has he married her?
He just announced today.
Oh, how marvelous. Oh, that's marvelous. She made it legitimate. She's a splendid... Her father's a very good actor, and she's a splendid good mother. And he's besotted with their child.
Aren't there difficulties, though, in doing biographies?
Well, he thinks the rest of the world thinks he's too young.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in the interim while waiting for him to come along. I think his great test is going to be when his film comes out at the end of the year, The Color Purple, how he treats black people. And he thinks that this is going to be... I was with him in North Carolina when he was making that, and he thinks this is going to be his first adult film. And it may be the first American adult film. They haven't made too many. Not entertainment, but adult.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that... There are films which go beyond sheer entertainment value. And The Color Purple is the story of how black women have been mistreated by their black lovers and husbands. But Alice Walker, the author of the novel, puts it down to the fact that the honkies, you and me, the whites, have so mistreated the black males, that they've taken the manhood out of black males, and black males' only resource is to take it out on their black women. And it's a fascinating... She's a great writer.
It's a specious argument, and it'll be interesting to see, however, how Spielberg handles it.
As you can imagine, in North Carolina, there's a great deal of hostility. North Carolina is not the most advanced part of the world.
Can't buy a drink there, either.
You cannot. You certainly can't in Monroe.
You know that they're not advanced if you can... You're dying of thirst and you can't go into Bloody Mary at the time you need it the most.
Everybody else can buy drinks except you or the visitor when you come in. All they get in their supplies, but you can't buy a drink if you land at a motel.
I have to say, England is almost as bad. You can't start drinking there till 6 in the afternoon or evening.
Nonsense.
And
if you're
sightseeing, you go to the museums, and around 5 o'clock, that's when you really need it and you can't get it.
Well, half past 5. You only got half an hour.
Well, it's not good enough.
I agree.
At 11 o'clock, they close it off at 11 o'clock.
I agree.
It's almost as bad as North Carolina.
Yeah, almost as bad, but not really.
Well, you're certainly a fascinating man, Leonard Mosley, and... I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and talk to me. I really enjoyed Disney's World. I had a particular interest.
I'd like to emphasize that he is a great man. America should be very proud of him. And I think they've got to learn to, and I think they have learned, to grow up and admire their husbands, their heroes who have feet of clay.
Leonard Mosley, thank you very much.
Thank you.